before turning to the stuff that we want to discuss, especially today, and which grows out of your reading and whatnot, I want to pick back up just a bit on some of the things that were being said yesterday. And in particular, I want to call your attention to what I think is a very interesting way that Mark operates in putting together his story. We discussed certain ways in which he has attempted to tell the Jesus story in a certain fashion, and that he uses certain devices to do that. There are many, that we looked at yesterday was his way of arranging geography so that geography meant theology. But I want to note, or have us note, another interesting device that is perhaps even more significant than that. It's simply an example of the way he puts stories together. Yesterday, I don't know how well I emphasized, but I wanted to try to make clear that in that period of time before any Gospels were written, that all of the stories and the sayings of Jesus that were known in the Christian community had not been placed in any order necessarily. They simply were stories that people told, usually in the context of teaching or preaching, and that it was first of all Mark who took that and placed it in some kind of order. And that means that it remained for him to use, the Christian would say, of course, under the guidance of the Spirit. But it remained for him to use his creativity and his mind in putting that material together the way he did. And in doing that, as a kind of editor, he had theological viewpoints in mind, or he had things he wanted to stress. I want to show you one of the ways that he did put his material together that makes a lot of theological sense if one notes it and understands what he's doing. Will you please look in your Bibles in chapter 8 in Mark? As you know, there are several stories in all of the Gospels about the healing of blind people. One might ask the question, well, why were so many people blind? Or why were these stories reported, etc.? In any case, they are one example of the sorts of healing miracles that Jesus performed. Well, in Mark 8:22, if you'll look at that, please, that's the story of the healing of the blind man at Bethsaida. It says there, "There people brought a blind man to Jesus, and they begged him to touch him. He took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the village, and then he spat on his eyes, laid his hands upon them, and asked whether he could see anything. The man's sight began to come back, and he said, 'I see men. They look like trees, but they're walking about.' Jesus laid his hands on his eyes again. He looked hard, and now he was cured so that he saw everything clearly. And Jesus sent him home saying, do not tell anyone in the village." Now, here in 8:22 is a story of Jesus healing a blind man. If you'll turn over to chapter 10, you find another story of Jesus healing a blind person. It's in 10:46 and following. They're on their way to Jericho. As he was leaving the town with his disciples and a large crowd, Bartimaeus, the son of Timaeus, a blind beggar, was seated at the roadside. Hearing that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to shout, "Son of David, Jesus, have pity on me." Many of the people told him to hold his tongue, but he shouted all the more, "Son of David, have pity on me." Jesus stopped and said, "Call him." So they called the blind man and said, "Take heart, stand up, he's calling you." At that he threw off his cloak, sprang up, and came to Jesus. Jesus said to him, "What do you want me to do for you?" "Master," the blind man answered, I want my sight back." And Jesus said to him, "Go, your faith has cured you." And at once he recovered his sight, and he followed him on the road. Now, here we have in chapter 8 and in chapter 10, two healings of a blind person. In the intervening material, which we won't look at in detail, in the chapters that go between those two blind stories, you have a remarkable series of narratives which tell about how Jesus, when he instructs and talks and teaches his disciples, how they do not understand. That is to say, how they are blind. They are not physically blind, they are spiritually blind. The contrast is so apparent that one can only conclude that this is another one of the devices that Mark, as a theologian and a preacher, uses to get across a point. In fact, it fits in with that larger theme that we talked about at the end yesterday, namely the obtuseness of the disciples who don't see until the very end. Now, a lot of theological ideas are being expressed here, but what I would suggest as the main one is that Jesus can help the physically blind to see, and at the same time that they do that, they are having much more restored to them than their physical sight. It is their faith that cures them, as it says directly. But as opposed to these poor beggars or these blind people, those who on the fringes of society can hardly make their way, in comparison to them, the inner circle, Jesus' disciples, are not able to see. It's an old motif that you find outside of the Bible, even in pagan literature, that of having your sight, a sight which enables you to see spiritual truths, stories, many of them in the ancient world, around religious themes, of how people with their sight cannot see, but people who are blind can see. To take one example from extra-biblical literature, those of you who have read Oedipus Rex, or perhaps some of the other tragedies of the Greek corpus, a fellow who crops up in many of these stories, Tiresias, I almost couldn't think of his name. Tiresias is a prophet. He can't see, he's blind. But what he does have is inner or spiritual sight. He's the blind man who really sees. Everyone else around him sees physically, but they don't have any spiritual insight. Well, here's a technique I would suggest of Mark, who in putting together his material arranges that material in such a way as he brings out certain contrasts and comparisons to get across a larger major theological idea, which, as I suggested yesterday in Mark, was that one has their eyes opened, that is to say that the disciples had their eyes opened only when they saw the resurrected Lord. Before that, their insight was partial. It was not fully spiritual. They didn't completely perceive. How many times doesn't it say in Mark that they did not understand, or they were spiritually blind, or they could not quite fathom what Jesus was about? Now, one other thing in Mark before we move on. I'd asked you the day before that as you read the Gospel of Mark to attempt to note in a general way the structure or the outline of that material. Scholars believe, and I think it's apparent to anyone who's reading a scripture a bit more than simply superficially, scholars believe that no biblical writer, whether Old or New Testament writer, put their material together without a definite idea or structure in mind, the way they wanted to tell the story. Modern writers do the same thing, of course. In reading Mark, and as we'll see also in John, Mark has structured his material in a very clear and also a clever way, clever in the sense of putting it together so that it gets across a theological point. Every reader will outline the Gospel of Mark differently, but one way that it can be done is roughly in this way, and let me, I don't know if you want to copy that down, but let me show you how I outlined it or how it's possible for one to do it, and to note that each block of this material, I'm not sure if you can even read this board because it's sort of gooped up with old chalk and whatnot, but in any case, let me show you the progression of main themes as they make their way in the Gospel of Mark. In 1:1-13, you have introductory material. Jesus is not a babe, he's a grown man. He begins his ministry, however, with an encounter with John the Baptist. In the next section, 1:14-3:12, you have a group of stories that have, I believe, principally to do with the authority of Jesus as it manifests itself in word and deed. This is the material, for the most part, in the region of Galilee. So in that first part, it is the authority of Jesus as it's portrayed in what he does and in what he says. In the second section, after the introduction, 3:13-6:6a, A means the first part of the verse. By the way, you all realize that chapter and verse was not an original part of the inspired scripture, that was added really quite late, after the Reformation era, in fact, simply for the sake of having some unity in citing the passages in the writings of some of the, well, the writings of the church fathers or the writings of the reformers. They'll say, as it says somewhere in Isaiah or in Matthew or wherever, they didn't have chapter and verse to cite. If you find books where they do, those older scholars do cite chapter and verse, it's simply a modern editor has found that passage and then added it. So, in other words, there's nothing sacred about chapter and verse markings. And sometimes, those who added those chapters and verses didn't do a very good job. That is to say, they didn't make the major breaks where, in fact, one might nowadays believe that the major break occurs. Hence, the division here between 6:6a as the second part and 6:6b, the beginning of a brand new section. They did that rather haphazardly, so when we have to divide even verses to show the division between major sections, it's not anything so unusual. In 3:13-6:6a, you have the main theme explored, namely, Son of God as rejected by his own people. After that section on authority, then Jesus meets opposition, but opposition among his own people. Can you recall back to your reading now a day or two ago, in what way does Mark express the fact that Jesus is rejected? What do I mean here by his own people? Who is that? Pardon?
By the Jews.
By the Jews?
By his disciples.
Yeah, by his disciples. No, they've not rejected him yet. Galileans? Who in Galilee?
Galilee.
Hometown, for one thing. He goes to Nazareth, and what do they say? Yeah, what's this guy who's the carpenter's son doing making all these airs about divine authority? They genuinely take offense at him. All right, they're his own, but there's another sense in which his own have problems with him. Who are his own in that other sense? Do you recall?
Oh, his mother and sisters and brothers.
Yeah, what do they think?
They think he's crazy.
Exactly. Did you notice that when you read that? Can anybody quickly find that verse? It's in 3:21, I believe. Have a look at that quickly. That's a very astounding thing, it seems to me. They think this guy's nuts. In 3:20 in Mark, he entered a house, and once more such a crowd collected round him that they had no chance to eat. And when his family heard of this, they set out to take charge of him. In the Greek, that's very strong. Take charge of him, we would say today, if you want to put that in modern idiom, the white coats came after him, or what, to put him in a straitjacket. The guys from the insane asylum come after Jesus, or would have. They set out to take charge of him, for people were saying that he was out of his mind. An alternative to translating that, as your footnote will say, is that they said he is out of his mind. The Greek is even stronger than that. The Greek says they thought he was crazy, that he had lost his mind. So Mark wants to show that Jesus' opposition, which, as remember, as the gospel goes along and he gets closer to Jerusalem, remember, he finally gets to Jerusalem, that's where the authorities are really after him. But that opposition has begun already as early as chapter 3 when his very family rejects him. The note of rejection, therefore, is very strong in Mark. And as the gospel goes along, it gets stronger. Margaret, please?
No?
Okay. Any other questions here? Now, the next section, after this rejection by his own people, Nazareth, his disciples aren't understanding, his family thinks he's crazy, people have no faith. Then you come to 3:6b to 8:21, where Jesus, again, presented as the Son of God, and especially in this section now, is he misunderstood by his disciples. 6:52, just to give examples, says their minds were closed. 7:18, he says to them, are you as dull as the rest? Don't you perceive? Or 8:17, he says, do you still not understand? Or can you not see? That's in that section that I explained before, where you have a series of narratives where disciples are spiritually blinded, and yet the poor beggars are both able to physically and spiritually see. That's 6:6b to 8:21. 8:22 to 26 I have in parentheses. That's a transition section to the next major section. This transition section down here in 10:46 are these blind stories, restoring of the sight of the blind. They frame a section 8:27, that's the next major one now, 8:27 to 10:45. The main theme of that is Christology. Who is Jesus as the Christ? Christology is a word that refers to, in general, a study of all of the messianic titles or epithets given to Jesus. Jesus the Messiah, Jesus, Son of David, Jesus, Son of God, etc. That's what Christology is, and that's dealt with in this section. This section, then, is Christology and Christian discipleship in the light of the Passion. So it's right in this part here that you begin to have predictions of the Passion. Jesus has been carrying on his ministry. He's healed. He's preached. People believe. Others do not. Many stumble. And now, by the time we get this far in the gospel, Jesus has begun to look forward to the end and to instruct his disciples about what is to come. 8:31 is where you have the first prediction of the Passion, and that's a kind of turning point into another major section. Then in 11:1, that's after 8:27 to 10:45. 11:1 to 12:44, you have then another division, and that's the days in Jerusalem prior to the Passion. Here you have a series of narratives of what Jesus does with his disciples. You have the famous cleansing of the temple passage, the entry into Jerusalem, etc. Then you have chapter 13 up at the top on the other side, which is a unit for its own sake alone. Steve referred to it yesterday as the apocalyptic discourse, which it is. There Jesus talks like an apocalyptic visionary. He speaks of the end of the world, and he does it in very dramatic and bizarre terms. And then the last section of the gospel, 14:1 to 16:8, is the Passion narrative. Now, I've wanted to go over this in that much detail, and that's not that much, in order to, when we now look at the structure of John, that we can note the comparisons and see the different way John has laid out his gospel, and that will be a help to us as we begin with assignments for tomorrow and following, as we begin to consider much smaller units of the gospel. In the second chapter of the Moody Smith reading in this book, he talks there primarily about the structure, or we might say the outline, of the book of John. Before we go back and consider his first chapter, let's make a comparison now between the way Mark has laid out his material and the way John does it. How, in the most simple terms, how does Smith, in his second chapter, how does he suggest that one outline or divide the material in John? Someone say or recapitulate that for us? What are the main divisions of the book of John? In your readings, you may find it very helpful when you're being inundated by a mass of detail, either by Marsh or by Smith or whoever else, that you may find it very helpful to take notes on the essentials, so that when it comes time to discuss or deal with the stuff in class, you don't have to flip back through the book and say, oh no, where was that? You will have already distilled it pretty much on paper for yourself, so that it's much easier for you to either remember or to go back to. Now he goes into some detail about chapter 3 and 4 deal with this, and 4 and 5 deal with that. But what I'm asking is, what did he present as, right on the very first page, as the main outline of John? Anybody?
It's more of a public ministry between all the Jews in the area.
Okay.
And the last part is the
okay, that's a good start. Can you recall what this is now John? He said public ministry. What chapters in the book of John does Jesus going about publicly, preaching, proclaiming, and all that?
2 to 12,
correct. 2 to 12 is public ministry. He's going about with his disciples. He's doing all of the things that he has to do. What's chapter 1? What's the nature of it? For the most part, introductory. Chapter, or verse 1, 1 to 18 is usually called the prologue, where you have those famous and very powerful words about Jesus. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and etc. The Logos theology, which we'll consider in detail later. So chapter 1 serves pretty much as an introduction. 2 to 12, public ministry. Then what's the next major part? How does he suggest that you divide that?
13 to 20.
13 to 20. Alright, what's in that? Alright, he's with his disciples, especially in the first part, and after he is with them, instructing them, what comes next? The end, which is the Passion and the Resurrection stories. So we might say this part has... maybe we should break that down into 13 to 18 and 19 to 20. Is that the correct way? 13 to 18 is his farewell address. Am I correct that 19 is where? No, 18 is already Passion. Couldn't remember. Instruction. Then Passion. Or suffering and resurrection. And what's the last part? Chapter 21 is?
After.
Pardon?
It's just like an afterthought service.
Afterthought, postscript, we'll call it, or you can call it an epilogue if you wish, some such thing. So what you have is chapter 1 and chapter 21 frame it, sort of introduction, epilogue. And then in the middle, you have two main divisions, public ministry, and then in 13 to 17, private instruction to his disciples, his farewell address. He's about to die. He's giving his last will and testament, in a sense, which is what many scholars regard that as to its form. It is a testament in the Latin sense of the term. It's his last will. Then... concluding with Passion and Resurrection, and then a postscript, which some scholars regard as an addition to the original Gospel of John after it had been written and reached its conclusion. You have sort of an epilogue tacked on to the end of it, almost anticlimactic in a way. Now, what are some of the ways that you would find apparent as to the differences between the way Mark has structured his material and the way John has? What are the superficial and obvious things that one sees here? Make a guess. Don't be afraid to venture a guess that turns out to be wrong.
Mark
Patty?
Well, Mark's is more geographical than historical.
All right, we've seen something about, all right, that's, there is certainly geographical notations being made in John, but as we observed yesterday, Mark has Jesus coming from the north to the south in one long trek, the few side excursions, where he culminates in Jerusalem. Smith has also reminded us in the first chapter there that Jesus goes in and out of Jerusalem several times. That's one thing. How about simply the structure, if you think of it? What about this division between 2 to 12 and 13 to 20? How does that compare or contrast with what you read about Mark before? John?
It seems like there's a bigger bulk of the Gospel of John.
Okay, he is in Jerusalem more. But what simply about this division between 2 to 12 and 3 to 20? Quite aside from, leave Jerusalem out of that for a minute. Is that the way Mark did it?
Wasn't it more spread out in Mark? He was doing things all through it.
Okay. Expand on that. That's right. What is he doing all through it?
Well, he's performing more things. His public ministry is all through Mark, instead of just right in one section.
All right. That's right. That's part of... Elaborate on that just a bit, please.
I think in Mark he's doing more miracles and signs than in John he's doing more preaching.
Very important point. Very important point. One of the reasons that I wanted you to read Mark and then come to John, and we'll explore this at length later, but it's very good to get that fixed in our minds, is that in Mark we had just within every few verses a new little story, a healing story, a pronouncement story, a disputation with the Pharisees, or he goes to the synagogue and preaches, or something like that. And most of the time, the little unit is very brief. And Jesus went there and he did this, and then he went on and he did that. And that usually takes place within the compass of just maybe 5, 6, at the most 10 verses. Whereas in John, you find after Jesus is described as doing something, performing a miracle, then he goes into a long sermon. Those are called the discourses. And you'll want to hang on to that term. We'll use it over and over again because we'll want to examine those in detail later. John presents Jesus, more than Mark does, as a preacher. His discourses are long. They're for a chapter or two sometimes. Whereas really in Mark, as well as in Matthew and Luke, except for the Sermon on the Mount or the Sermon on the Plain, except for those, Jesus never gives these extended orations. He just talks a little bit. What is it that you would have me do? Oh, Lord, I would like to be healed. Then, you know, he does something or says something and the person is healed. Or he cures the paralytic or whatever it is. He never talks at length. Margaret? That's good. That would hint, would it not, at the fact that each writer has in mind to stress different things than the other does. I mean, that's very nice for us who are the readers because... we've got four versions which give us spiritual insights from different sides of everything. Now, we'll have to return later to the notion about whether or not John is a complementary or a supplementary book in addition to the synoptics. The relationship between John and the synoptics we'll have to look at separately, but as far as details are concerned, this would be one of the things one might observe. But we were on to something a minute ago with Susan's comment that a couple of the rest of you, Marcy and Jim and Chris, had hands up about that. We were going to explore something about this division of public ministry and private ministry. Can we get more specific on that, Jim?
Well, like in Mark, it's always mixed. Like he could tell a parable and then he'd get aside with his disciples and explain it to them. There's just that whole transition, and the big break is between, like you said yesterday, Galilee and Jerusalem. But here the big break is between the rest of the people and then his disciples. And you could sort of picture it as that same progression towards intensity and holiness and everything. He's just the farther along he goes, the more deep, or the deeper, the more intense are the things that he reveals to his disciples.
Very good. Please note that, therefore, that in all through all of these segments of the Gospel of Mark, Jesus goes and he does some things, he gets tired out, the mass of the crowd presses upon him. Mark is emphasizing Jesus' humanity very much. Mark saves the stuff about Jesus' divinity till the end. Jesus is a very ordinary kind of individual as far as his physical resources are concerned. Of course, he demonstrates his divinity by the miracles and by the insight or the prophetic things that he says. But he's nevertheless presented as one who gets tired out and who must go off and retreat or go off and pray. And when he does that, usually takes his disciples with him and he talks to them privately. Chapter 4, for example, the stuff about the parables where Jesus has his disciples with him and they talk intimately. No one else is around. He instructs them. And then a few chapters later, same thing happens. They go off. He's with his disciples. He tries to help them understand. They go off to a mountain. It's the transfiguration story. Some of the disciples are with him. They gain a new insight. No one else is around. Only they are permitted to see his glory. So there is this, how might one say, there's a succession of Jesus preaching to the public and then to his disciples, then the public, then the disciples, as Mark tells it. John wants to present it a different way. Public ministry all belongs in one section, more or less, and then toward the end, Jesus gathers his disciples around him. He instructs them. He tells them what is about to come. He prays to God in chapter 17, the so-called high priestly prayer of Jesus. And so we then observe that the two writers have taken material about Jesus' life, but they've put it together in a different way, and they've done that usually with a theological intention, but also with some kind of a dramatic or literary intention as well. The dramatic and the literary intentions all, of course, are in the service of the proclamation of the gospel. That is to say, they never wrote these gospels just to give us information. They're interested in facts, but they're interested in the meaning of those facts, and we'll want to take that topic up in a second when we take Marsh's introductory stuff and talk about it in a moment, namely his rather felicitous distinction between what takes place and what goes on. We'll talk about that in just a second. Are there other comments, however, before we move into that about this stuff? John, and then Sean, please.
I noticed that when I was reading John, that it seemed like Jesus was a lot less pressed by the crowds. I mean, like when he went to Samaria, he stayed there for a couple of days and went over this place, and they said, why don't you stay here for a few days? And he said, okay. So he stayed there. And it didn't seem like he was really pressed to go from one place to the next, like he saw in Mark.
Do you see a theological meaning to that, other than just the difference? I mean, can you, and what do you think is the possible interpretation of that?
But I don't know, I can make it.
Venture a guess.
Much more of a relaxed attitude to be able to preach longer. You know, like you could get into more of a just plain out and out discussion or exposition instead of going here and preaching for a while and going over here and making sure these people see that, going over here and making sure these people know something. It seemed to be more of a take it as it comes and just so you could hear them out fully.
Okay. Jim and then Bob and then John?
Well, on that sort of like, in John it's like, well, just the way it starts out, in the beginning was the Word, you know, and in Mark it's, like you're saying, it's a lot more human and everything, and in John you get more the aspect of the eternalness, you know, the divinity part of him, and like when you think of the God part of Jesus, he's not going to get uptight when people are around him, you know, he may be in the middle of that pressure, but he's going to be on top of it all the time, and that's why I think it seems a little more relaxed, just because it's the Son of God and he can handle it.
John seems to stress that divinity's part pretty much from the outset, right away, whereas Mark holds off. You don't really perceive Jesus' divinity until the resurrection day. In fact, the thing that's very important in the Gospel of Mark is that when Jesus is crucified, it's over, apparently. I mean, for Jewish law, to be crucified as a criminal means that you've been cursed by God. And what that did for the disciples' mind, in the disciples' mind, is that all the claims that Jesus had made were invalidated. He ended in ignominy, an ignominious death. But that wasn't the last word. 3 days later, there's the resurrection. With John, Jesus from the beginning is the resurrected one, so to speak. One perceives his glory, it says. The glory was made apparent already at the beginning. So John has a different way. Some say, beginning with Clement of Alexandria, that it's a more spiritual way. He's presenting Jesus already from the point of view of the end of Jesus' life, whereas Mark has to build up to it. Let's see, other comments here. Who did I see a second ago? Bob, you had a comment, please.
Well, just a comment on what John said.
Okay.
I guess I kind of see it in the same aspect. I don't know how this pertains, but you know, like sometimes you'll get a guest speaker at a banquet or something, and he'll give a talk. And, the talk is really a good, inspiring, inspirational discussion or whatever. And you go to talk to the guy afterwards, and you find out, he's really, he doesn't really believe what he said, or he doesn't talk to you very long, or he's got to go someplace else, or you've got some other engagement, you want to talk to him. And it seems to me like when you read John, you get the feeling that, Christ is somebody you can have a discussion with. You can sit down, you can talk with him, and he's not worried about catching a plane to Miami or something to talk to the Miami Dolphins or something. It's just somebody you can sit down and talk with him about, and you can have a discussion, and you can relate with him. He doesn't preach something and then go to Chicago and talk to another group of businessmen, and then go to fly to New York and talk to another group. And I get that idea from Mark, that he's got something to say and he keeps floating around, and you don't really see the other side of him where you can relate to him and you can talk things over.
Yeah, that you surely get that impression. I suppose it wouldn't be blasphemous to call him in John the Christ of the bull session, as opposed to Mark. He's got time to talk. Someone else over here before Marcy. Dean?
My impression of in John that Jesus has a lot more power. He seems to be in control of the situation and much more confident about his own position, in that he is declaring to the people in various places who he is and exactly what the significance of him is. Whereas in Mark, he seems to be telling people that when he does a miracle or a healing, he says, "Don't tell other people about me," as if his time is not yet, as if he doesn't have the power yet, or that he thinks that I don't want to be revealed like that. And he kind of puts people down, and the way the crowd presses him, he seems to be wearing out, and he runs from this place to that, trying to get away from people. I just saw in John a lot more powerful figure to be.
Yeah, that's... Marcy and then Eric, please.
Yeah, I think I picked up something in Smith. I wish I could remember where it was, but there was a time difference, that in Mark his ministry was much shorter, and it seemed like he was just burning himself out, running around and doing all this stuff, while in John it was over several years, I think.
Yeah, let's make sure that we note that. Commonly we are taught, I think, at least I was in Sunday school, that Jesus' ministry lasted about 3 years, beginning with age 30, running to about age 33. Smith made the comment, and I think that we have to reckon with that as being accurate, that as one reads the Gospel of Mark, there's every indication that Mark is presenting his ministry as having taken place within about a year or less. Whereas in the Gospel of John sees Jesus' ministry as going about 3 years. And though one can't immediately see that John presented a more relaxed ministry because he saw Jesus in terms of working for 3 years, nevertheless, the correlation is certainly possible. In any case, the very rapid fire movement of Jesus' activity in Mark and the sense that he's always overburdened with work, boy, we can identify with that, can't we? Most of us? Except we never very often get to retreat away from the pressing of our duties, our studies, etc. Please?
Do you think that Mark was probably pretty anxious to get the gospel written, maybe that is why did it in such a hurry and made Jesus appear to be in such a hurry all the time? Because it was the first gospel written?
You know, that's not too far-fetched. I don't know whether one could assume that he really was hurrying a lot to get it written, but as a matter of fact, and this is something that I had thought earlier I would go into but decided not to for lack of time, but I'll mention it briefly. In Mark's gospel, it is true that Mark, much more than the others, Matthew, Luke, and John, that Mark believes that the end time is about to take place. There is an apocalyptic tone, an expectation of the return and the end and all that very soon. And he believes, or he is in fact addressing a community which believes that. It's a kind of apocalyptic drama in three acts, in a way. This would be another way to understand the way Mark puts his stuff together. I'll mention it simply briefly. As Mark presents his apocalyptic drama, the first act is John the Baptist. John the Baptist preaches and is delivered up. The word is used of John the Baptist, delivered up. Jesus preaches and is delivered up. He's crucified. Now, after all that's taken place, Mark is writing and is addressing a community which is engaged in preaching, and it is now experiencing the first tastes of oppression and opposition in such a way that you can be delivered up. And when that deliverance, that being delivered up occurs in Mark's view, then Jesus returns on the clouds of heaven. So it has that apocalyptic cast. Mark believes that he and his community are standing before the imminent return of Jesus. Now, by the way, this is in a way parenthetic. When Matthew and Luke are written some years after Mark, one of the things that they as theologians and as writers of the gospel deal with is this, what had been an important crisis now, is the fact that the parousia, the return of Jesus, has not taken place. So what do you do? Well, you have to reinterpret some things. You push back almost to an indefinite period the expectation of Jesus' return. So that in Luke, for example, especially as that's expressed in a very important and famous book by Hans Conzelmann, originally written in German, it's now called The Theology of Luke. It's a version, original version is called the Mitte der Zeit, in the middle of time. He shows there how Luke writes his gospel in such a way as to remove from people's immediate thoughts the notion that Jesus is coming back soon, we have to wait and get ready, and that coming is in the future, and our job now, according to him, is to build the church, to preach the gospel. This is the age of the Spirit, in which the Spirit moves about and brings people to faith, and when the end comes, that's no longer of great concern. Paul, being the Jew that he was and having grown up out of an apocalyptic environment, believed himself that he would see Jesus before he died. Corinthians, Colossians, Ephesians all shows that Paul shared that early belief. They had to reinterpret their theology, in other words. We move on. Yes, please, Sean.
I was going to say that it's kind of been said before that Mark had that problem with the secrecy that you were talking about yesterday, and John doesn't have that at all. He's bold about who he is, or about who Christ is.
Okay, that's a good comment. That's a good comment. The secrecy motif we talked briefly about yesterday, where Jesus hushes people up on the one hand, and on the other, those who are supposed to know, they don't really know until the end. That doesn't seem to find any currency in the Gospel of John. It's not a device, so to speak, used by John to get across his message. Eric? Yeah, I missed you all ago. Sorry.
On the same point about John, as I mentioned before, that Mark, the Jesus of Mark is more human. Could you see that secrecy as being simply a human element, like he's a reluctant Messiah? He really isn't quite willing at this point to take on that the full reality of what he is. And he's sort of a little bit hesitant, and so he's willing to perform, you know, healings, miracles, but when someone really presses him to the point, he backs away.
That's an interesting way to look at it, and I think that's very possible to put it that way. Putting it in those terms would be a way of emphasizing the genuine humanity of our Lord, but not without foundation. Your phrase reluctant Messiah is very interesting to me. As a matter of fact, he was a reluctant Messiah, but why was he, or in what way was he reluctant? Jesus had a problem with the term Messiah. What was that? And it's part of his reluctancy, Jim.
And they expected him to be a king right now. Like, as soon as they came and tried to take him by force and make him king, somehow disappeared. But he didn't. He wanted to emphasize that his kingdom wasn't of that world at that time.
Exactly. And what that means is that Jesus placed quite a radical and new interpretation on the notion of Messiah. What are Messiahs? Essentially, they were kings, but they were kings who did salvation things. That is to say, old Israelite kings, or at least kings who were expected to come and straighten things out, were kings who could save us in a political sense, in a physical, worldly sense, not in an otherworldly sense, at least not originally. What do kings therefore have? They've got power and they have authority. Why did Peter say to Jesus, remember that thing we looked at yesterday in chapter 8 or 10 in Mark? It's at Caesarea Philippi, and Jesus said, who is it that people say that I am? And they said, oh, you know, some say Elijah, some say the prophet, some say Moses, some say whatever. Who do you say that I am, Peter? You are
the Christ,
the Son of God. And then Jesus said, that's right. And he said, I'll tell you something else. You know, pretty soon I'm going to suffer and die. Peter said, oh no, how can that be? Why does Peter say that? He is a Jew. And a Jew has no conception of a Messiah who suffers. Because Messiahs don't suffer. What they do is they come in on the clouds, or they come from somewhere, and they reign in power and they straighten things out. And that was the political messianic hope. And Jesus rejected that. He really never liked the term Messiah. In fact, according to one of the Gospels, he never used that term until he gets into a discussion with the guys right before his crucifixion, with Caiaphas and Pilate and those, where he admits to being a king, but not of this world. Jesus was much more comfortable, as a matter of fact, with another image drawn from the Old Testament in order to explain who he was, and that was the image of the suffering servant of Isaiah, of 2nd Isaiah, that group of chapters in chapter 40 to 56. Jesus liked to see himself in those terms. And so there's a way in which he radically reinterprets the messianic expectations. We want to take a break so that we don't sit for too long, kind of preparation really, to beginning with tomorrow and subsequent times, to zeroing in on specific and much more limited segments of John, and we'll go into more detail with passages and study them at some length and depth, I hope. What Smith does in chapter 1 is that he sort of summarizes for us ways in which John is unique. Now, we've been talking about that more or less since 9:30, but let's note especially the things that he underlines about the differences between John and the Synoptic Gospels. Not so much now theologically, although that too, as to matters of style and the way of presenting things. We've already talked about the difference in the outline or the structure of the two books. It's the presentation is different. We talked about how Jesus appears differently in John as compared to Mark. And there's, however, a topic which Smith talks about, namely he speaks about style and vocabulary and language usage. What are some of the things that he notes about that with respect to John, say, in the Synoptics? There are things that, for example, that are not contained in John. Chris?
The pronouncement stories and the parables and
okay.
Demons.
And what was the last?
Demon exorcisms.
Okay. Any more? Pronouncement stories, parables, demon exorcisms. He explains very briefly what a pronouncement story is. We've not really noticed that particularly. Yesterday when I wrote on the board, and you were mentioning several of these categories, I don't know if we noted pronouncement stories. A pronouncement story is what? Jacob Smith. Chris?
Problem and answer, kind of, they're asking Jesus a question and he'll give them up. Why then?
Okay, exactly. Pronouncement stories, like miracles, are usually very brief. Somebody comes, there's some problem, some issue, they ask Jesus a question, and he then, at the end, makes a pronouncement. He gives some kind of an answer to it. Sometimes miracle stories can hardly be distinguished from a pronouncement story, because at the end of a miracle he will make a pronouncement. Okay, parables, exorcisms. You would have noticed that in Mark there are demon exorcisms all over the place. John doesn't have a one. John doesn't have one. That's very strange. The whole business of demon exorcisms and miracles we will probably get into a little bit later when we, in one of our sessions, will at length attempt to consider the problem of miracles, how one interprets them, what they mean in a modern day, whether they mean anything at all, and how we ought to understand them. At that time we can talk a bit about demon exorcisms, an old subject which was made popular 3 or 4 years ago by the movie The Exorcist, which I've never seen, and which I'm not sure I want to see. Have any of you seen that? I guess that's it. I don't even know if the movie goes around anymore. I'm not sure. But I found that people who used to not believe in demons, having seen that movie, all of a sudden did. And that intrigues me, especially in classes that I teach, where we frequently have a discussion about whether there are in fact demons or not, and whether you have to believe in demons and demon exorcism. Well, we'll come to that later. Sue, please.
Why differences in just specific events that were in one but weren't in the others?
Okay, can you name a couple?
Well, the raising of Lazarus was in John, but it wasn't in anything.
Okay, remember, it might be good to just memorize cold some of the things, such as the fact that the raising of Lazarus is in John, but it is not in the other Gospels. There is a raising from the dead story in Luke 7, which is the widow of Nain's son or daughter. Which is it? It's the son. That's a resurrection story, but there's no elaborate, detailed story such as you find in John, where you have the story of Lazarus in John 11. Name anything else that's not in John or that is in John?
the transfiguration wasn't in John, and like the Samaritan woman and Nicodemus were in John, but they weren't in.
Okay, very good. The story of Nicodemus and the Samaritan woman are peculiar to John. Okay, the water to wine story, one that we'll be considering in some detail in a couple of days. Very, very intriguing story when we consider it from the point of view of John Marsh's interpretation. I think that we'll have some fun with that particular story. Yeah, the wedding at Canaan is not included. For the Christian practice and church sacrament, what also is missing from John? No story about the institution of the Lord's Supper. That's a real theological problem that we'll get into when we discuss chapter 6 of John. Anything else you can think of that you recall from or note in Smith's book, please?
The Sermon on the Mount.
Sermon on the Mount is missing from John. It's also missing from Mark. You didn't find any Sermon on the Mount in Mark. According to our scheme from yesterday, that means that Matthew and Luke may well be dependent upon the same source, the Q source perhaps. Please?
The infancy narratives are missing from John and Mark.
Infancy stories are missing from John and Mark. That's a thing that we'll deal with in some detail tomorrow when we do read the beginning of all of these Gospels. We'll have to discuss that also from a theological point of view. Why did Mark and John choose not to include an infancy story? Or, if they didn't choose to leave it out, why did they not know of it? Or why does Paul refer not one time to infancy stories? We might find some clues there to the way people develop their beliefs about Jesus, which I think is kind of interesting. We'll have to discuss that some more. Well, okay, what we've essentially said is that there's stuff that's peculiar to John that others don't have. There are things in the synoptics that John doesn't have. There are, however, some things that they share or that John has said and told a little bit differently. Anything else about the comparison between the two that one might note? Well, all of this boils down to one thing we want to constantly keep before us, and that is that John is unique in a way that almost surpasses scholars and students' ability to completely explain or to relate to the Synoptic Gospels. And for many people, John is the favorite gospel. Favorite perhaps because it's not only very unique, but because it has a quality of presenting Jesus as Lord in a much more stark and what spiritual way, if we want to use Clement of Alexandria's thinking or language.
Yeah, one thing I noticed was the phrase "truly, truly, I say to you." That church just becomes Pharisee, or is it there more behind that?
Truly, truly, I say to you. Very frequently, Jesus begins a wise word with that kind of an introduction. Who spoke? What kind of a language pattern is he borrowing there? Does anybody know? Truly, truly, I say to you. It's a rabbinic technique, some scholars tell us. That rabbis speak in one way, lawyers speak in another, prophets speak in another. Different language patterns, and Jesus, in a way, is speaking with authority and sort of like a rabbi who is a teacher. Truly, truly, I say to you. Verily, verily, I say to you, as it has it in the old King James Version. If we switch over now in the last minutes to the reading in Marsh, I want to take up some of the things in this, I hope it wasn't too long, a section for you to digest. You probably were muttering under your breath the whole time. Or not everybody was able to read this, no doubt, because not everyone has this book. Certain things in that reading that I want to discuss just a bit. and I'd like to see if there's any things that are on your mind particularly about it. The thing that I think is very useful that Marsh says there at the outset, pretty much, especially around pages 18 and following, is that he's talking about history and historiography. Now, the word historiography means nothing more than the writing of history, graphe, grapheo, the Greek to write, which term we get our word graphics, other terms, historiography. The concern in that little section is to talk about the historicity, in a way, of biblical events, but not so much the question of whether this or that event was historical, but rather what kind of historiographical devices, Marsh speaks of, did the writers use in order to convey their message. He uses makes the distinction between what goes on and what takes place. Let's explore that just a little bit to be sure that we've got that under our belts, because that will be a helpful distinction in many instances when it comes to our trying to interpret a passage or a narrative in one of the Gospels. Well, what's the big deal here? Why does Marsh go into this, and what's the upshot of it all? What's the difference between the phrase "what takes place" and the phrase "what goes on"? Chris?
Well, he said that in one instance, Mark, just by the clothes that John the Baptist was wearing, it said something about, you know, that's something you just look at, you know. But by the clothes he was wearing, it kind of symbolized him as a herald of Jesus in some way, because he was dressed the same way as Elijah.
Okay, correct. That's one of the examples that he used to express the difference. What is it that is taking place here? The fact that John the Baptist is appearing in the Judean desert and is there and preaching and baptizing and raising quite a bit of Cain with people. That's what's taking place. What's going on? The second part that you mentioned, namely, that Mark or the others describe John the Baptist in such a way that for the Jewish mind who knows their Jewish history, this guy John the Baptist looks like something else besides just John the Baptist. He is reminiscent of the Old Testament prophet Elijah. That may not tell you and me too much, but it told the Jews of Jesus' time a lot. It said to them that John the Baptist is a herald for the messianic appearance. Why? Because Jews believed that before the Messiah could come, that an Elijah figure would be a forerunner who would pave the way. Now, if you had a camera and you're taking a picture of all that, what you would see is what's taking place. You'd see John the Baptist, and you'd see people going out there, and you'd see him baptizing them, and see his aggravating the officials, and et cetera, et cetera. You'd see him baptize Jesus. But the other dimension, the deeper dimension, the symbolic significance to all that, and the meaning of it, is that this guy is an Elijah. And his presence means that the Messiah is about to be there. So that's the difference between what takes place and what goes on. Now, Marsh talks about the difference between an analyst and a historian. What's the difference between one who writes annals and one who writes history? Somebody up in the balcony there. Steve, can you take a stab? If you wrote annals, what would you be concerned to write down? Anybody else? Take a stab.
Mere facts.
You'd just be chronicling the mere facts. You'd say on January 11th, holding people met around the fireplace, and they studied the Gospel of John, etc. On January 12th, they did such and such. An analyst simply records that which can be seen more or less with the naked eye. The historian is concerned with another dimension, and that is to explain, well, why did certain things happen? Not just how they happened, but the why. What are the cause and effects of certain things? The analyst records that the Second World War took place. The historian is one who wants to probe into the reasons that things developed in such a way that they did. Why were people drawn to Hitler? Why was Hitler able to do such and such without any opposition? The historian interprets. In other words, the word history has two meanings. The word history refers to the events themselves, but it also refers to event plus interpretation. Now, how does all this apply to Scripture and the Bible, etc.? It seems to me that it's important in this respect, that in no place do we ever have very much, in Old or New Testament, simply an analytic report. We always have history plus the other dimension, namely interpretation. The John the Baptist thing is one. Marsh mentions another example, and that is the crucifixion. Anybody could see that Jesus was crucified. The other dimension to that, or the event plus meaning is, or plus interpretation is, that that death was or had significance in a redemptive sense. That death brought about the reconciliation of the world to God and God to the world. That's the religious or the spiritual dimension. And so really at every turn in the Gospels, you have our writers not only telling us what takes place, what goes on. Now, Marsh uses a word that is a very problematic word for many people, and he uses it and then leaves it and never explains too much about it. He assumes, I suppose, that his readers have an understanding of what he's getting at. He uses the word that makes some people's blood boil, namely myth. Did you notice that he used the word myth? Now, he doesn't use it much anymore, so it's not all that important, but let's get something straight about the word myth. When you find interpreters of the Scripture as well as interpreters of ancient literature using the word myth, they inevitably use it in a different sense than we use it in common parlance. We say in response to something that sounds like a tall tale or something that is not credible, ah, that's just a myth. That's not really true, is what we mean to say. Now, the word myth, which comes from the Greek word mythos, does not mean something that isn't true. Excuse me. It means a story. It means a narrative. And it has, in literary, in the subject area of literary criticism, of biblical and non-biblical, especially non-biblical literature, myth does not mean in the first instance that which is not true, nor does it in the first instance mean Greek mythology, which we in the modern world do not regard as necessarily factual. It means rather story which has an interpretation to it. In other words, if we would use the term in that sense with respect to, say, the crucifixion, the fact would be Jesus died. The myth would be that he died for the sins of the world. Now there I don't mean that he didn't die for the sins of the world. I mean that that's the interpretation. And that's the sense in which he means, or he uses myth. That's page 18 or 19, thereabouts. Now he uses that in the context of his explanation of the transition between what takes place and what is going on. And frequently that's the way the term is used. If you're familiar with the writings of Rudolf Bultmann, very problematic New Testament theologian who often spoke of demythologizing the New Testament, the term myth often gets used very much in his attempt to adapt stories which are set in a truly mythological framework, namely the idea that the earth is flat with heaven up here and hell beneath, and with angels coming to earth from up there and demons and devils coming from the world beneath, and this is a flat three-story universe. That is a mythological conception of the world which we do not share anymore. And Bultmann's concern was to remove the mythological trappings from that worldview and try to pull out the kernel of what the New Testament had to say. That's another way in which the term myth had gained quite a bit of currency. Well, do you have any questions on that whole business about the distinction between history and its interpretation? Marsh then, in that introductory material, goes into some detail about the question of the authorship and the date of the Gospel of John, and I want to spend just a minute on that, perhaps to clarify that as best we can. Perhaps you've gathered by now that, or from other courses you've had in biblical studies, that authorship is a problematic thing with respect to biblical books. Problematic not so much for the one who reads the Bible for spiritual sustenance as the biblical critic or analyst who asks historical questions. Who wrote this book? When was it written? To what audience? Why? What is the background out of which its vocabulary comes, etc.? These are all questions that we will be dealing with, and they're questions that the historian of biblical literature is very interested in. Unfortunately, they're questions usually to which there are no satisfactory or unanimously agreed upon answers. Now, as far as the authorship of biblical books is concerned, please be reminded that neither Matthew, Mark, Luke, nor John, nor the Pentateuch, nor the book of Hebrews, nor several other books in their original form, in their original manuscripts, said anything about the author. That is to say, the first Greek manuscripts of our Gospels did not say Gospel according to Matthew, Gospel according to Luke, etc. It was not until the second century that those names were added to the manuscripts. So in other words, there's nothing infallible or inspired about those names as they attach to the Gospels. On the other hand, in many cases there's no reason to doubt the oral tradition that was handed on until the second century, which claims that a Matthew or a Mark or a Luke or whoever wrote those Gospels. As far as John is concerned, the gist of Marsh's comments on that is, well, what? What is his view about the authorship of the Gospel we're going to be studying? Who does he suggest as the most probable candidate for authorship? Jim?
Well, initially, like, John Mark was the source of a lot of the information.
Who was John Mark? What do we know about that?
He was one of the 12 disciples. Yeah, he was known. He was from a wealthy family in Jerusalem, so he probably had ties with the high priest.
Is that correct?
He wasn't.
No, he wasn't really a disciple. That's a little confusing the way it's presented there. Let's make sure that we get these Johns all straight. When I was a youth, I always thought that John the Baptist and John the disciple were the same. There's John the Baptist. There's John the son of Zebedee, who is the brother of James. He's the disciple. Then there's a guy called John the Elder. You don't find him mentioned in the Bible, but he lived in the ancient world around that area, perhaps in Ephesus, and he's known from other writings, from bishops and church fathers. Then there's John Mark. Okay. John the Baptist, John the son of Zebedee, John the Elder, and John Mark. In Marsh's view, you're correct. It is John Mark who is most probably the writer. He rules out John the disciple as being the probable author of this book for what sorts of reasons, do you recall? There's several he gives. Bud? He would have been too old for one thing. He would have been probably pretty near 100 years old, give or take a few years, but almost. Anything else?
Well, I was just wondering, because John Mark is mentioned in Acts, right?
Correct.
So he'd have to have been just around about the same time as John the disciple. So I was wondering what the difference between those two people would be. Are they just saying that John Mark was necessarily younger?
Very good question. Though he doesn't say specifically, he hints at believing, namely Marsh, and believing that John Mark could claim to be younger than John, the son of Zebedee, but he doesn't give any real historical, or he gives no footnotes. He gives no empirical evidence for that. Okay, that's another one of those reasons that places him in doubt. You will have noticed, I hope, however, that when John Marsh, begins, he got another John there, when he begins his discussion of that, he does note that there are things in favor of considering John, the son of Zebedee, as the author. In other words, people haven't held this over the years just for no reason at all. It's got some possibility to it. Eric was...
That kind of argument really would hold water, the one about his not having been able to write it because he hadn't had the education, because he could easily have dictated it to someone, the same way that Jeremiah may have dictated to Baruch.
Well, they were talking about style and language, just fluency of speech. Marsh's point was just...
Oh, okay, all right.
Well, assuming he wrote it as an old man, maybe he'd been exposed possibly to a kind of environment, I don't know.
Yeah, these are all very good speculations. And you can see that Marsh is floundering, as have all scholars. What you have to do, and he's correct in my view, at the end you have to say, we really don't know. But there's a theological thing we have to tack on to that in a second. Footnote.
I got a question. It's just friends of mine that have taken Greek always told me that Gospel of John is the easiest to read in Greek.
That is true, in my opinion. When I studied Greek, the first thing we read was John because it was easier. Style was easier. Luke approximates a kind of classical Greek style. The vocabulary is harder, the syntax is more complicated, etc. So I think you're suggesting, well, maybe this was the language of a fisherman who... Yeah, that's a question that one would at least want to raise. Another thing he does say, though, along the same line, is that how would... If John, the disciple, is the one who wrote it, how would he have gotten it published, and how would he have been the one to know the officials and the high priest at the time of Jesus' resurrection? That was another thing that gets added in there, complicates it more. Marcy, please, first.
Well, isn't there also a John, they wrote Revelation and the John epistles and those John stuff? Are there any connections between...
Yeah. Good question. In the New Testament, there are four documents that are attributed to a John. Gospel of John, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, those brief letters, and the book of Revelation, the very last book, which is attributed to John. In the old days, the assumption was that it's all the same John. For 80, 90 years, that's been questioned. One thing that I believe is pretty well established and isn't open to dispute on the basis of language usage and theology and viewpoint and all those tools of the literary critic, is that the book of Revelation is written by a different person than the Gospels and the letters. Now, whichever Johns they were, they are thought to have been different Johns. That's true. Jim?
Well, with John the disciple, also there was the prophecy that Jesus made about him and James, the sons of thunder, that they'd be able to, that they would be crucified or a martyrdom death. And then wasn't there a tradition that James died at an early date, so probably John died at...
That's right. That's another complicating factor. There seems to be some indication, not without some historical basis probably, that John, the disciple, in fact, did die when James, his brother, did, and that they, in fact, were martyred. Let me state something that may be a puzzle to some of you, I don't know, and then we'll close. You may be asking, what's the big deal about authorship? If it says in the Bible that John wrote it, or that Mark or Matthew wrote it, then we ought to leave that as it is and go on from there and not question the scriptures. That's one possible way to approach things like this and say, you know, since the scholars don't agree, what the heck, let's simply assume that church tradition has always been correct. That's one way to approach it. As far as things like authorship and other historical questions, who, what, when, where, why, and to whom, and etc. These are questions that are answered, are to be answered, on the basis of empirical investigation. Therefore, in modern scholarship at least, whether you want to accept it or not, of course, is your own personal viewpoint, modern scholarship approaches those questions from a historical point of view, and it says, okay, if John is the author, what's the evidence? Okay, if Moses is the author of the Pentateuch, what's the evidence? What speaks for, what speaks against? And that may appear to some people to be rather irreverent with respect to ancient tradition. But it's simply a part of the modern world, which also wants to treat the Bible as a book that is written by people and is therefore open to the use of all tools that we have to investigate literary products. That means that one can, on the one hand, believe that the Bible is the Word of God and is a spiritual message, but on the other hand, that one is free to inquire into historical questions by using all of the methodology that we have today, the study of archaeology, the study of history, the study of languages, the study of syntax and grammar, the study of historical milieu, etc. I'm suggesting that one keep in mind the distinction between asking of the scriptures historical questions, which you then try to find evidence for and you weigh it, that on the one hand, and the other, reading the scripture for a spiritual or theological message. They're two different methodologies, but I'm not suggesting that we get schizophrenic about it and keep those in two different separate camps. In other words, I'm saying that the devoted Christian biblical reader can avail themselves of all of the tools of modern linguistic study, plus archaeology, plus history, and that to do that, to analyze, to study from a historical point of view, does not in the end do damage to the biblical material, but indeed enhances it because it furthers our understanding and draws us more into the world of the biblical material. So if you meet views expressed in Marsh or other books that seem to be too analytic, dissecting the biblical material too much for you, recall that the purpose there is to further the understanding rather than to obscure it. May I give you the assignment for tomorrow? Hopefully my syllabus suitcase will arrive today and I won't have to have you write things down from now on. Please do this. Well, where is it? Here. First place, please study carefully John 1, verses 1 to 18. And after you've done that, I would like you to read in Matthew and in Luke especially. Might have a look at Mark again. That's fairly fresh in your minds. Have a look at the first couple of chapters of Matthew and of Luke. Matthew chapter 1 and 2. Let me see if it's exactly 1 and 2 in Luke. I think maybe it goes further than that. No, I guess it doesn't. Yeah, go through 1, 2, and 3 in Luke. So that means read that prologue in John 1, 1 to 18, Matthew 1 and 2, and Luke 1, 2, and 3, and make a brief kind of comparison for your own study of the differences between those, and then when you get to Marsh's comment on that, you'll want to note how he interprets the different theological viewpoint that each of those has about Jesus' beginnings. But before you go to Marsh, after reading those three, I want you to read Smith, pages 20 to 31. Smith, 20 to 31. He there gives a brief exegesis of the prologue in John. And then, finally, Marsh, 93-112. So in addition to those few biblical chapters, five or six chapters, you will be reading about 20-something pages, which I don't think is too much. Now, will you write a couple more things down? These are the two guiding questions that I want you to have in mind as you do this, and questions that we'll want to take up tomorrow. Number one, as far as the John reading is concerned, what is the meaning and the significance of the term logos, or word, as it's translated in English? What is the meaning and the significance of the word logos, or word? In the beginning was the word. That Jesus is called the word, and the Greek term is logos. What's that all about? What are the Greek and the Hebrew roots behind that term? Be prepared to discuss that. The second guiding question is, it's really the one I've already mentioned, what are the theological differences in John's beginning as compared with Matthew, Mark, and Luke? Those are the two things. This question about theological differences of the beginnings is one that has to do with a historiographical device. Okay, that'll be it for today.